This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and just a word of caution, this show may include graphic language of a sexual nature. The statistics on campus sexual assault are startling. 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men experience sexual assault on campus. And recent reports indicate that no one in America is more at risk of being raped or assaulted than college women. Colleges around the country are facing increased pressure to respond to the issue, and more than 70 campuses are currently under investigation for how they've handled sexual assault cases. But addressing campus sexual assault requires more than policy changes. A student-led revolution is sparking a larger public conversation about gender-based discrimination and the culture of masculinity that perpetrates violence. Today we're going to spend the whole hour talking about the issue, and we will start with one of the women who is at the heart of the student-led effort. Andrea Pino is a sexual assault survivor. She co-authored the Title IX complaint against UNC Chapel Hill for its handling of sexual assault on campus. She graduated from UNC this spring and now helps survivors around the country learn about their Title IX rights and to help them file complaints about violations. Andrea Pino, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Andrea, you are considered one of the founders of the sexual assault movement on campus. I'd like you to take us back a few years when your activism began. Tell us how you first started on anti-violence efforts.
Yeah, so I never thought I would see myself in Los Angeles, California, working on and rape on campus or really being at the forefront of a student-led movement. I was a first-generation student from Miami, Florida, so I was an out-of-state student at UNC Chapel Hill. And, you know, my first few weeks were very rough, adjusting to campus, not really knowing anyone, and slowly finding out about the spirit of activism and leadership on UNC's campus. Now, it wasn't until I was involved with One Act, which was a student-led peer education training, that I started learning more about the intimate nature of sexual violence on campus and how, you know, even though as a woman in Miami, I was told much about sexual violence, I didn't think that it was such a prevalent problem at a place that was called the Priceless Gem, really. And it was my sophomore year that I became a survivor of sexual assault. I was accompanying a friend to a party, and after dancing with this guy, I ended up being dragged into a bathroom and was raped in many ways. And my assault is definitely one that fits that script of a very violent experience, which isn't really the common norm at a college campus. I wasn't intoxicated. He was. It was very violent, and I ended up walking home alone that night and woke up to a pool of blood. I was very confused as to what had happened to me. It seemed that I had had a concussion, and that's why I couldn't remember. I had this pulsing headache that lasted a few days. And I just sat alone by myself in the bathroom and didn't know what had happened to me. And it was that morning that I spoke to a friend and talked about how my body was and just the bruising. And if she had seen anything, and you know, she didn't really know what had happened either. And it really wasn't till a week after when I ran the Tobacco Trail half marathon in Durham that I realized that my body wasn't the same that it was a week before. And that became when I started looking at myself differently and began feeling ashamed of myself and began falling behind in my classes. And it was after approaching a professor that I wanted to drop a course that I then went to academic advising. And when I approached an academic advisor, I was told that I was just being lazy for dropping the course. And after working really hard to get into Carolina and get a scholarship to attend, it was very difficult for me to process that I wouldn't belong at a school that was my dream school for so long. And it was after then that I walked into the student union at UNC and I discovered these boxes that would allow students to anonymously report sexual assault. And that was the first time I called my experience a sexual assault. And it was through anonymously reporting that that I began my journey of discovering how to heal and how to kind of get back my college experience that I felt that I was losing.
Did you report forgive me for interrupting, but I do want to know, did you report the assault to that advisor when you said you were dropping the class?
I was actually cut off. I was talking about having a trauma, and then he cut me off. And then after feeling invalidated, I didn't actually tell him that I was assaulted. Mm. So, I mean, and that's often very much common on college campuses. Students don't really feel like they have the words to describe what happened to them, mainly because the last thing you want to think is that you've been raped. And especially since many people don't know how prevalent it is on college campuses, they don't think that their experience constitutes rape. And even my experience being as violent as it was, it took me a very long time to actually come to terms with it being rape. I mean, I called it assault for a few weeks. And then, you know, finally, it was actually after meeting Annie Clark, who is my partner in all this work, that I was actually able to call it rape. And really what I noticed after reporting through the box system, which was actually created by Annie Clark, was that the conversation was very much minimal about this issue. It was something that people kind of talked about here and there. It was very much just reserved for Sexual Assault Awareness Month, which is in April. And really, it wasn't until it happened to you that you really had to go about finding out these resources. They're not really kind of thrusted upon you when you enter campus. When you enter campus, you're kind of told, you know, go to the blue lights, call the police if you're attacked. And it's very much framed as being the stranger problem. I actually don't know who my assailant is. And a lot of that is because many of the witnesses the night of my assault weren't really up for the conversation. And a lot of that comes back to this being a cultural problem and the fact that people just don't know how to talk about rape. It's not exactly a commonplace conversation. And it's very difficult, not just for those that experience rape, but for those that are the intimate partners or friends of those that have experienced it. It's not a very easy conversation. It wasn't an easy conversation for my friends. It definitely wasn't for my family. And even now, it's very much a difficult conversation that I have to deal with whenever I apply to jobs or look into other schools for grad programs. It's something that kind of carries on with you.
Yeah. What led to your filing a complaint against UNC?
Yeah, so I mean, I was very much an active student leader on campus, and I was involved in student government, and I later became a resident assistant through UNC Housing. And it was really that summer, the summer after my rape, when I started talking more with Annie, and I was actually appointed to the search committee for the then deputy Title IX coordinator, who's now EW at UNC, that I learned about how Title IX fit in with sexual assault. I was actually a political science major at UNC, and I was very involved in research, specifically on policy framing, looking at how laws are formed and how they impact societal problems. And it was really by combining my research that I was doing in the classroom with what I was seeing during these search committee meetings and reading more about Title IX. And what I learned was the Dear Colleague letter, which was pushed by the Obama administration in 2011, that actually gave direct guidelines to universities about their responsibilities under Title IX. And I realized that UNC was not really following federal law. And I learned this personally, not just through my own experience, with the advisor that I approached not being trained, but as an RA being approached by many students, being told that they just simply did not feel supported by the university. I learned that assailants weren't expelled and that the university did not have a very good definition of consent and that there really wasn't any type of deterrence for sexual assault. Rather, there was a deterrence for coming forward. And that was widespread across campus. It seemed as if this issue was just another compliance measure. Every time I approached the administration about it, it was very much, you know, we take these allegations very seriously. We're doing something about it. But as an RA, I was not trained very well on how to help survivors. And I had dozens of survivors coming to me and nowhere to really take them to. And it was just really that reoccurring kind of hopelessness, not just in my own case, but in those of the students who came to me, that really pushed me to do something beyond just approaching administrators. And it was through my research that I learned about the Title IX complaint process. And it was through approaching students at Amherst and students at Yale that I learned about kind of efforts before ours and how this problem really was happening at campuses across the country and that we really weren't alone. And the funny thing behind our complaint was that we were five complainants that that pushed forward the UNC complaint, and actually the first ever lawsuit that alleged discrimination, sex discrimination under Title IX, was actually also five plaintiffs. So it was really by reading the history about Title IX and learning how what was happening to us at UNC had been had happened before and was happening at other campuses, that really assured us that we could do something for this issue, and that really we really could make history by not only making UNC safer and holding the administration accountable, but really motivating other students across the country to do it as well.
And I should say that we did ask the university for a reply or for a comment because we were about to do this program, and they said, quote, in response to your outreach about whether the university would like to comment, we thank you for the opportunity, but decline. The university has declined. So I want to take a break right here, Andrea, and then come back and talk with you a little bit more and then broaden our conversation as we continue the conversation about sexual assault on campus. Today on The State of Things, I'm talking with Andrea Pino, a sexual assault survivor who now helps others around the country. The conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacia. We are talking about the epidemic of sexual assault on America's college campuses today, and we were talking with Andrea Pino, whose experience at UNC Chapel Hill put her in the headlines and at the forefront of efforts to make changes on college campuses across the country and in federal legislation. And Andrea, I know you've been very active helping to write some of the federal legislation that might lead to change. Can you tell us about your efforts there?
And it's actually funny because I first went to visit Gillibrand's office during midterms, my final semester at UNC. So, I mean, I took a mega bus there, and then Annie and I decided to just walk to Gillibrand's office, mainly because of her past support of military sexual violence survivors. So we approached her staff with no appointment and just said we have this issue that we think that the senator will be very passionate about. And, you know, we told a little bit about what had happened to us at UNC and a little bit about what we were doing nationally. And, her staff immediately walked outside and gave us a good 45-minute meeting. And it was about finals time when I finally met the senator, and she quickly announced her support of our efforts and really her willingness to write a bill that will hopefully make things better on college campuses. And since that meeting, we've been working with Gillibrand staff almost weekly, and we actually did help write the CASA Act, which is hasn't been announced yet on the floor, but we hope that it might make it before this Congress expires.
And Kirsten, just to let people know, Kirsten Gillibrand is a senator from New York who's been working on this legislation and largely because of your efforts. So, again, tell us more about where that is now and what you're looking at.
Yeah, so we actually helped write it this past summer, and it was introduced in July with an incredible bipartisan coalition, including my state senator, Marco Rubio, as well as Senator Grassley from Iowa. So there definitely is some very strong Republican support as well. And right now, really, it's just waiting floor time. And a lot of what's going on with ISIS is really holding that back. So we don't know where the bill will stand come the end of this Congress. So we were hoping for some floor time, but we're not really sure. There is a possibility for some December floor time, but that's not guaranteed. So right now, what we're doing is kind of pushing our efforts to raise more awareness so that more senators will jump on the bill. There's also a House equivalent. And Renee Elmers is actually also backing that bill. So there definitely is some interest from North Carolina as well. And we're actually also working on some state efforts to also bring up the enthusiasm. So California just passed the Yes Means Yes consent bill that has basically codified what counts as consent.
What does that look like to you? Does that look to you like it should be model legislation?
I think so. I mean, it seems very radical, and it really isn't. It basically just it affirms that anything that does not constitute a yes is sexual assault, and this includes intoxication. If a student is just not at the point where they can actually consent, and it also includes withdrawal of consent. So it seems something that a lot of the criticism has been, well, you know, if people say yes and if they go about enthusiastic consent, that kind of kills sex drive. And really what it's saying is that sex and rape are not the same thing. And that's something that we also saw at UNC. It was the fact that a lot of students didn't really know that if you do not have consent, then that's rape. And people don't recognize that what looks as not violent and really just involving alcohol, involving drugs, in which one of the partners cannot actively consent, then that's rape, that's a crime. And our young men and our young women can commit these crimes if they do not have consent. And I think what California is doing here is definitely pushing that conversation. And they're pushing it beyond federal complaints and beyond the conversation of specific universities. And they're bringing a call to all students and all universities in California that if we do not talk about this more, then there's going to be some serious, serious consequences. And a lot of it...
Go ahead. Finish that.
And I think it's definitely an amazing step in the right direction. And I would love to see North Carolina do it. And I think it's definitely needed. I think that we need efforts both in the Capitol and also in the state to really do something about this problem.
Andrea, we are going to continue the conversation. I want to thank you so much. Andrea Pino is a sexual assault survivor who now helps others around the country learn about their Title IX rights and file complaints. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
On the program today, we're talking about sexual assault on college campuses and how a student-led revolution has sparked new conversations about the issue. Schools around the country are under pressure to confront what's called an epidemic, and many argue that this requires a deeper understanding of the cultural and social dynamics that fuel the problem. It means looking at the language we use and talking about this and messages we send through the media. It means thinking about systems of oppression and notions of masculinity. Joining us now to talk about this are two experts on sexual assault and prevention. Juliette Grimmett is founder of Chrysalis Network, an organization that provides training, consulting, and counseling around sexual assault issues in the state of North Carolina. Juliette, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us also is the executive director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault, Monika Johnson-Hostler. Welcome back, Monika.
Thank you for having me again.
Let's start by talking, Monika, first about the importance of language and terminology. I mean, we talk about sexual assault as a continuum. Tell us about the importance of understanding it that way.
Absolutely. Andrea touched upon that a little bit. I think you've heard me say before that we talk about sexual violence in a continuum for several reasons. One, because it allows each individual to have their own language around describing what has happened to them. And so we use overarching terms like sexual violence or sexual assault, but also because state laws differ from state to state. And so it's important to us that people don't get hung up on what rape means in North Carolina versus what it means in South Carolina. And so on that continuum for us is forced touching and fondling, which we do define in our criminal statutes as sexual battery, which we would then say all the way to first degree forcible rape. And we believe that everything on that continuum is equally as harmful to survivors. And so we give language and credence to validate survivors' experiences wherever they are on the continuum.
Learning language is important. Unlearning misconceptions, equally important. Juliette, you've been working on issues of sexual violence and prevention for almost two decades. What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you find in training people about these issues?
Absolutely. I think there's certainly a lot of misconceptions. But when I thought about this, to me, there's one misconception in particular that I think seeps down into a variety of other misconceptions, that being that alcohol is the cause for rape on campus. And we know that this isn't true from a variety of research, particularly David Lisak, who's done a lot of research on what we know as non-stranger rape on campus that is committed by college men who perpetrate on known victims. And what they found is that the majority of these rapes are repeat offenses, that they're committed in a way that is planned and intentional, and that, in fact, when we look more into the data, 90% of rapes on campus are being committed by these repeat offenders. And so when we look at alcohol, which was one of the factors in some of these cases, we can certainly see that alcohol is often used as a tool by perpetrators to commit those acts. But when we say that alcohol is the problem, then we run into a lot of dangerous implications and outcomes of that, one of which is often this idea that rape is an accident and a miscommunication that could happen. There's also a lot of value that's placed on experiences for survivors who have had, have experienced a rape that may fall under what we're talking about, where alcohol was involved and it's a known stranger. And I think that this in particular is a problem. A couple years ago, I was at bond court with a survivor who experienced rape from a known person and alcohol was involved. And the judge asked me right before determining bond, "Hey, Juliette, come here. Can you tell me, was this a real rape or was this one of those college sort of alcohol facilitated rapes?" And it was in that moment that I really, you know, thought about how intentional our language needs to be about when we're talking about alcohol. Is that
weapon. Well, not only does the shining the light on the fact that these are repeat offenders, and often so these offenses then often begin in high school. The number
Absolutely.
Of 13-year-olds who have some sort of record of this is shocking.
Yep, that's the average age that they have found for folks who choose to perpetrate rape. Average age is at the age of 13.
And then we find that then once it becomes a plan, mm-hmm. Alcohol is a tool. And that says nothing about the fact that when the judge asked that question, and so many others mm-hmm. do, suddenly the survivor becomes the victim, or the light is shined on them as somehow responsible for this, and the perpetrator is out of the limelight.
Absolutely. And that's what I would say was sort of the other big problem that comes out of this is then that leads to, we already know that rape is one of the most underreported, if not the most underreported crime, and for a variety of reasons. And that being one of them is this self-blame that occurs for an individual, but is also, you know, emphasized by the culture that we live in and what we see on TV and how we see alcohol's role and the lack of accountability on the actual behavior of the perpetrator.
Let me stick with you for just another minute and ask you if there are models of prevention now on campuses across the country or anywhere in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think those of us, Monica included, who've been doing this work for a long time are always looking for the best models that are out there. There's a lot of folks who are doing some really good work. I think what's been really important to me, and you started the segment talking about language, is that primary prevention of sexual violence requires us to fundamentally change the responsibility narrative from survivor behavior to perpetrator and community accountability. And so to me, that needs to manifest itself into any type of multi-level, and I'm saying multi-level because that's really when you're asking model programs. We need to be doing multi-level interventions on our campuses, from working with administrators to employees to students, and not just a one-time deal, right? It needs to be ongoing. It needs to be tailored and culturally specific to the variety of pockets of cultures on campus.
Monica, tell us more about that, because diversity, certainly there is a wide range of diversity of colleges and universities. What part would that play in shaping these prevention programs?
Absolutely. And when Julia talked about the multi-levels, starting from administrators to our students, and those trainings being intentional, deliberate, and ongoing, I think is also most important. But when we talk about culture in North Carolina, we're a smaller state, but we have a number of college campuses, including our public universities, our private institutions, but also our community colleges. And each of those have their own specific culture as it relates to the type of university they are, the type of students who apply and attend those universities. But then you also have the individualized cultures that we know that are created on our college campuses. So they're, you know, racial and ethnicity affinity groups. And the list goes on in terms of affinity groups. And so for us, when we talk about trainings and model trainings, we really try to make sure, and I think I can speak for both Juliet and I, we agree that whatever training models you use should then be tailored specifically to that university and the culture that they have. And so when you're working on a multi-level, you hear from the administrator to students and the faculty and staff included what their campus is like. And so, for instance, we are in the process of providing all freshman training for Shaw University, Bennett College, and North Carolina State A&T. And so for us, we realized that while those three are HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, all of those trainings are very different based on the size, population, and culture of those universities. And so I think I just use that as an example to say, on the face, people would say that those campuses are very similar. But then when you get down to actually talking about community accountability and the narrative change that Julia talked about, it's important to be speaking directly to those students at that university.
And Julia, you've worked on a program at App State, mm-hmm. right, that
yep.
focuses on engaging all levels. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the work that Appalachian State is doing. And they have housed an interpersonal violence council, from what I gather, for several years. And one of the outgrowths that have come from that council is this idea that they really wanted to make some significant culture shifts and changes on campus, starting with the higher level folks. And so they have committed to providing anyone on their campus considered an employee in a supervisory role with some form of training. And so I've created a 3-hour curriculum in partnership with them. And starting next week, I'm going to be providing 15 sessions, 3-hour sessions from through the month of October and some of November to every single employee that serves in that role.
And just to sort of concretize this, or mm-hmm. to make it more concrete, one can imagine Andrea's advisor mm-hmm. had that training,
absolutely.
There's a possibility that when they heard the word trauma, mm-hmm. they didn't interrupt and say, you're just being lazy. They might have thought, key word here, I'd better listen.
Absolutely. And as Andrea was speaking, and I forgot to say this earlier, the first thing I wanted to do was thank her for her courage and all the work that she's done that's allowed Monique and I to even be here talking about it at this level. But that's exactly it. I did a trial session to get the university approval with the chancellor and her cabinet and a number of directors and deans. And that's a lot of what we were talking about is now they have these tools and resources, and for them to sort of go back to their departments and be the ambassadors. And this is sort of their first step of this piece of training. They're already doing some bigger level trainings with students. They have an online module that they're using and some face-to-face. But this training is going to sort of pave the way for their next phase. They're not just stopping at the supervisory level. They want to do some other pieces too.
You know, to think about why sexual assault is such a staggering problem on college campuses, we need to take another step back and look some of the cultural and sociological dynamics. Joining us now is NC State sociology professor Michael Schwalbe. He is a gender scholar who studies the relationship between masculinity and violence. Welcome back, Michael. Good to have you.
Glad to be back.
What are some of the cultural messages that we see that can reinforce some of this behavior on campus?
Well, in our culture, men are still taught that to be respectable as men, they should be strong, they should be powerful, they should be able to control their environments or things in their environments and get what they're after, even in the face of resistance. And those messages come from all directions, really, from the time boys are little. Those messages come from sports, from other media, films, popular music, video games, military, pornography. So young men in our culture are still getting these messages that to be real men, they should be strong and powerful and heterosexually potent.
There are probably reasons for this. I would imagine that to survive in this economy, one that privileges competition and victory and strength over weakness, and frankly, exploiting weakness, it's actually a virtue in this economy. And so, therefore, the message is culturally appropriate in some ways.
Absolutely. In a capitalist society, we're pitted against each other, really, to make a living. And men are taught to strive for status and power in the workplace. And so being competitive really isn't optional if men want to succeed in this kind of economy. And so, as I say, that's a general message that boys and men get about what it means to be a respectable man. And I think young men, college-age men, don't have a lot of institutional power to feel this way in any other way. And so it manifests a lot of times in their interpersonal relationships and high-risk behavior.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that because it's interesting that the particularity of the peculiarness of the college environment can make things worse for young men.
Well, it can because they're in a kind of status competition with other men. And as I say, they don't have much institutional power or authority. So that's why we see self-destructive behavior, some of the binge drinking, the high-risk behavior. And sometimes this manifests in a kind of sexual conquesting that comes at the expense of young women.
And those who are sort of glorified on campus tend to be those who represent that hypermasculinity. They tend to be male athletes or perhaps, you know, in fraternities and that kind of thing. Well, Juliet, I know that you've led masculinity trainings around the state. What's your approach to getting that conversation going?
Sure. Well, I certainly, in terms of masculinity trainings, that I always do my work in collaboration with folks. And so my approach to doing that work has always come from, and I worked with Dr. Schwabe at NC State when I was there several years ago. And my work in terms of masculinity is having the conversation that is looking at our individual roles and looking at sexual violence as a community problem, not, you know, you can't, nobody responds well to feeling attacked. And so trying to connect with all men about why this is a problem and that the reality is sexual violence will not end until we have gender equality and really all forms of equality.
Monica, this can be a difficult conversation, though, can it? Because ultimately it would challenge men, white men, to examine their privilege, and nobody wants to acknowledge that, and particularly if they had to give it up once they recognized it.
Well said. I think there are a couple things that were said here that speaks to that. You started out by framing our work as social justice and ending all forms of oppression, and we talked a little bit about that, and that's what's important to me about recognizing is we often talk about being pitted against each other, and that's what we're talking about when we talk about men giving up something. And I think for me, again, it's a change of the narrative of recognizing that men actually gain something when women are treated fairly and equally and our vulnerable populations are seen as valuable and equal citizens. And so, but we also know that the challenge of that is not just economy, but we live in a capitalistic society. And so every piece of perpetuating sexual violence fuels our economy through our advertisement, through everything that we see is actually built into our economy. And so I think it's important to notice changing the narrative is going to be a long process, and I'm glad we're engaged.
Monica Johnson-Hostler, the executive director of the North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Juliet Grimmett, founder of the Chrysalis Network, providing training and consulting. Thank both of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Our conversation will continue with Michael Schwalbe from NC State and more on the state of things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Last week, the White House unveiled a new campaign against campus sexual assault called It's On Us. It targets men in particular and encourages them to get involved in combating sexual assault on campus.
It is on all of us to reject the quiet tolerance of sexual assault and to refuse to accept what's unacceptable. And we especially need our young men to show women the respect they deserve and to recognize sexual assault and to do their part to stop it.
Now, scholars argue that involving men in this movement requires sensitivity and honest conversations about male privilege. We're going to talk about a new program at UNC Chapel Hill that's engaging young men in this conversation. We want to continue our conversation now with NC State Sociology Professor Michael Schwalbe, who studies the relationship between violence and masculinity. What's your response to the It's On Us campaign, Michael?
Well, I think it's on us to go beyond platitudes and public statements to make some of the kinds of policy changes and institute the prevention programs that Monica and Juliet were talking about earlier and that Andrea is pursuing through legislative action. But I think when I hear Obama's statement, I can't help but notice that there's a terrible contradiction between telling young men that they should not be violent and conducting U.S. foreign policy through violent means. There's a message there about what men do to get what they want, and if the message is or the technique is to bomb people, it's pretty clear that violence is a tool that one might use.
Well, and I think that amplifies what Monica said just before the break. It's not that this is some aberration in our system. We've actually developed a system that requires violence against those who are weak. We're on this continent by forcing people off of the land that they lived on. And before that, in Europe, people were forced off their land and looking for jobs as a form of capital formation. So we see these violences essential to the process. Can any of these programs work if we don't sort of look at the foundation of a system that requires violence in order to sustain and reproduce itself?
Well, they need to be cultural interventions, critical cultural interventions. And Monica is talking about that at the level of the campus culture. But this really needs to be a message that we get out into the culture as a whole. And I would argue that in the long run, just as Juliet said, as long as we have gender inequality, we're going to have this kind of violence, that we need a larger cultural and economic and political transformation of our society to really overcome these problems in the long run.
We are talking more about it. You've been working on this for a long time and studying it. Have you seen an evolution in men's involvement in this question?
I wish I could say that I've seen a more encouraging evolution of men's involvement. I've been doing this work going back, some of it, into the 80s and then early 90s, NC State's campus and more generally in writing about it. And it's always been a minority of men, a small group, who come to a kind of critical awareness of some of these problems and are willing to get off the path of least resistance and start trying to make some changes. And I'm always encouraged whenever I see young men and older men getting involved in doing this. But I wish I could be more optimistic based on what I've seen.
Well, let's talk with one of those groups now and see how our optimism perhaps grows when we're joined by three guests from UNC Chapel Hill to talk about a new campus-wide initiative to increase men's involvement in gender equality and violence prevention. The UNC Men's Project is a 12-week-long voluntary program that encourages male-identified students to explore their masculinity. Bob Pleasance is Assistant Director of the UNC Chapel Hill Learning Center. He founded the program. Hello, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Zach Padgett and Blake Fulton are two students who participated in the program. Zach and Blake, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Bob, tell us about this program. Why did you get it started?
So for the past 5 years, up until August of this year, I was the UNC's Interpersonal Violence Prevention Coordinator, which was the first position on campus whose role it was to work with students, faculty, and staff to prevent violence on campus, including sexual assault. And I think one thing that my colleagues and I noticed while we were doing this work was that men were underrepresented, as Michael was alluding to earlier, at campus events and campus programming and really on all our efforts on campus. And so we wanted to figure out a way to include more men and to get more men involved. And so my colleagues and I developed a program in addition to One Act and Haven programs that sort of took a bystander approach and approached everyone as allies, not approaching men as perpetrators, but as allies. We wanted to go even further than that. And we had the opportunity via a grant from the Verizon Foundation last year to create a program that had two main goals, the first of which was to get men explicitly involved in violence prevention, and the second of which was to help men have a conversation critically around masculinity and its relationship to violence, its relationship to sexism, and to promote a more positive, nonviolent, non-sexist masculinity, which in itself is a longer form game of violence prevention.
When you talk about approaching men as allies, not perpetrators, what do you mean? How does that change?
So I think historically, violence prevention it still happens in some places, but I think the movement has gotten a little more savvy in realizing that it's not helpful when you try to do violence prevention to approach all women as potential victims and saying, here's how you protect yourself against sexual assault. And explicitly or not, approaching all men as potential perpetrators and saying, okay, guys, listen to what we're saying here, because if you don't listen to us, you're going to accidentally rape someone. And so not only does that perpetuate the myth that Juliet spoke about earlier, but it also unintentionally or explicitly or not positions men as potential perpetrators. And we know that probably only 5% of men are perpetrators, but all men have the ability to be influential, to be allies, to speak out, and if we don't approach them as allies and talk about what their roles can be and how these efforts benefit men as well, as Monica said, then we're really, you know, losing key allies in this fight.
Well, Blake, let me ask you first how you came to become part of this program. What was it about the program that attracted you?
Well, I first heard about the program on an email listserv for SWAG, which is another group on campus, stands for Students Working for the Adequation of Gender, and they just sent out a general email that said, any male-identified students who would be interested in being with a group that talks about healthy masculinity and gender violence prevention and interpersonal violence prevention, you should apply to this program. And so I looked into it. I've been looking previously into getting more involved on campus with these kind of groups because I've been having these discussions more and more often. So I just decided to apply, and I got into the space, which was really helpful for me personally.
Had you thought much about your masculine identity before this all came up?
Not very frequently, but when I got to college, it was kind of a transition, and these conversations started to pop up more often when I would meet new individuals, and more specifically people who are already involved in these programs, groups that were already present. I would start having these conversations more often, and I become more aware of my own masculinity and how I express it and how other people express it as well.
Zach, how about you? How did you get involved?
So my story about getting involved is very similar to Blake's. I was and still am friends with, I don't know if she still is, but she was the editor of Siren Magazine on campus, which is a feminist magazine that has been recently revamped and reintroduced to the campus. And similar to Blake, she encouraged me to apply for the program because I'd been having critical conversations about gender and masculinity and feminism. and I was really eager to learn more and explore these concepts with a group of like-minded individuals. So I applied to the program and was introduced to the space.
Michael Schwalbe, let me ask you a question. We've just heard from only two men who are college students. Both of them talked about becoming engaged on campus in these conversations. Is that new? Is that something that's emerging? The very fact that men are actually seeing their masculinity as a thing that's worth talking about?
Well, actually, this has been going on for a long time. There's a long history of some men supporting women and feminism and reflecting on gender and gender inequality and feminism. And my involvement goes back to my undergraduate days in the 1970s. So when I was speaking before about the longer term, I've seen interest wax and wane. I've seen cycles of interest to some extent, it depends on what's going on in the larger culture. And sometimes incidents occur that focus people's attention and get people interested for a time. And then after that, interest may wane. So there's a long tradition, and I'm always encouraged when I see young men and young people in general thinking critically about these issues. I'd like to see more.
Bob, the class focuses on understanding how dominant forms of masculinity can also be hurtful to men, but then you have to keep that in context, right?
So that's definitely something that was foundational to our decision to how we framed the Men's Project. And Michael's work was actually influential in that regard in some of his studies of previous men's groups. And so we really wanted men to understand that male privilege is a thing that exists, right? If you look at men versus all the other genders, men are privileged in many different ways. However, all men feel constraints and pressure to live up to a certain masculinity that very few men can actually enact or live. And so there's really these two truths that we want men to understand in the program is that, yes, masculinity hurts a lot of men. A lot of us feel that pressure, suffer from those constraints. But as a collective, it also benefits us in ways that it doesn't benefit other genders. And so holding those two truths and helping men to critically explore masculinity for themselves, but also framing that in the context of social justice, also framing that in looking at other things such as heterosexism and sexism, racism, classism, other forms of inequality, and also particularly framing that within what men can do to help violence prevention efforts that already exist.
Well, Blake, let me start with you and ask how your consciousness has changed or has it as a result of the exercises in this program.
Yeah, well, most prominently, the biggest change that I've seen about myself is being able to notice these like very subtle interactions that people have, especially with language.
Name some.
Well, Jess, when people are talking, this one's a pretty common one. It's hard to keep track of, but you guys, referring to a group of all different genders as you guys. Another more common one that I've seen is just like it's more of like sexual violence, like language, when it's like, oh, I just got raped by a Tess, things like that. I heard that actually the other day, and I was surprised that he actually said it, but it's a lot of language-based stuff that people don't really think about because it's been integrated into how we speak and how our society operates.
How about you, Zach?
I really think because I had taken a women's studies course before going into the Men's Project program, so I was kind of tangentially aware of many of the issues that can be explored through feminism. So my consciousness changed more so in self-reflection on my gender and my own identity as masculine or not masculine. I really found a space in which I could question what it means to be masculine and what it means to even be male. And I started to really like question whether that label applied to me at all. And I really felt more empowered to question those things and to see the ways in which masculinity in the way that I embody masculinity affects people and the way that I embody other traits also affects people.
Michael Schwalbe, we certainly want to encourage any kind of efforts like this, but there is always the danger that when we collect men around this issue to become part of the solution, there's a chance that you end up reasserting your privilege because now you have this chance to be kind of gender charity. I will give you back some of what I've taken from you.
I suppose, and there's a critique of men's involvement in anti-violence work, and the critique is that just by being involved, men get extra status points. And clearly that can create some problems within the movement and within groups that are trying to work on this problem. And yes, there's also, I suppose, a problem of self-congratulation sometimes when men become peripherally involved without really doing the kind of transformative work, personal and political transformative work that the other guests have talked about.
Bob, is this something you're conscious of as you, you know, craft the program?
Absolutely. And I'm seeing Blake nod across the table at me because one of the lessons that I think we tried to instill in our participants was that we're not trying to set up a good guy, bad guy dichotomy, right? We're not trying to say that the participants of the Men's Project are the great men or are the only people on campus doing violence prevention. So certainly helping to make sure that the path laid out by women for decades has been acknowledged, that we're working with women. And that the program is not an ending. So we spent a whole session talking about what the next steps were, and part of those next steps were understanding what is your privilege in violence prevention spaces, and what is your privilege moving forward in doing this work, and how can you try to keep that in check? How can you be aware of it? And then how can you continue to do the work? Because it's continual work for men to be involved in this and to not reenact and reproduce right. those privileges.
Well, let me ask you, I'm going to ask all of you, but I'll start with you, Bob, about whether you've received any pushback for creating this program.
I think for the most part, people have questioned some of the same things that we've talked about before, and it's been more gentle questions of checking to see, you know, are you talking about privilege? Are you taking a privilege and an oppression lens? But I can't say that I've really, other than a couple of letters in the Daily Tar Heel or comments, you know, which are always going to happen. Other than that, nothing directly. I've really had a lot of support. And again, extra points, I think, for doing this work. Yeah. We're a young organization, and we've quickly gotten a lot of attention for doing the work, being on the UNC homepage, having articles written about us. So we want to be aware of that as we speak as well.
Yeah. Well, Blake, I want to ask you about that, though you're nodding in agreement. But when you also said, you know, this idea that we might be reasserting our privilege just by sort of making this step, as you become more aware, how do you move forward, you know, in your relationship, your personal relationships, kind of with this new consciousness? Can you integrate it? Does it become a kind of, you know, an impediment for you in just creating social relationships?
I mean, it just takes a bit of forethought before you start interacting with people. Just really take into account how your privilege plays into conversations and how it affects other people, being aware of your own presence before you start talking. And it kind of helps me to be more aware of myself and other people and really kind of establishing these different relationships, different types of relationships. And it hasn't been too much of an impediment for me personally. It's just been more of a process of being aware and having to come to terms with, like, this is how I should be acting, this is how I used to act, and also being a little bit surprised about how I used to act and how I used to talk and speak and things.
Zach, have you had conversations with men not in this program that you find surprising, or do you find yourself in conflict now and then?
So, yes, I do have conversations with many men who have not been in the project who say very troubling things and who embody masculinity in ways that are not the same kind of positive masculinity that I've encountered in other spaces. And it is difficult when, as also someone who identifies as male, to be in a space in which you're expected to be able to participate in these usually problematic conversations. And when people say things and talk about, like, sexual conquest, I think was mentioned, and people really freely talk about, like, sexual conquest and in a conquest kind of framing, being expected to be able to participate in such conversations, such offensive conversations, is sometimes quite difficult.
Do you challenge those conversations, though?
Most of the time, yes. Though there are times where it's still intimidating to feel as though it's difficult to feel empowered to step up and challenge these things, especially if you're sitting across another man, another male-identified person.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. I wish I had more time. Zach Padgett and Blake Fulton are two students who participate in the UNC Men's Project. Bob Pleasance founded the project. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you for having us.
And thanks to NC State Sociology Professor Michael Schwalbe. Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brett Wolf is our news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.